because I was a first-time writer for Hallmark, just learning their brand and, you know, what they look for in their films and their characters.
Hi, this is Leslie Lepage. I'm the founder of the La Femme International Film Festival, and this is Best in Fest, a podcast for people that want to learn about television and film. I have a wonderful guest today, Joelle Selner. She is amazing. She's an alum of the La Femme Film Festival, which we're super happy to have her on. But, you know, she has an interesting beginning on how she navigated her way into entertainment. She has written 9 and produced 9 romantic comedies and family telefilms for Hallmark and others, including Paris, Wine, and Romance. And her most recent Christmas rom-com was filmed in Scotland, and it's going to be released in Christmas 2022. So that's super exciting. She has written over 30 animated TV shows and web series, including the known Avengers, Mightiest Heroes, Ben 10, Omniverse, DC Superhero Girls, and Lego Friends. She has created adult animation, Super Slackers. She's written comics for Blizzard and DC, Marvel, and Dynamite Entertainment. So she's got a lot to give to us and for everyone listening in. So welcome, Joelle.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't know where you started from. You started from literally the streets and created a life, pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, which in itself should be a movie.
Hopefully it will be.
Yeah, hopefully it will be, exactly. But how did that happen for you? What was your journey into entertainment?
Yeah, I grew up with a single mom, and when I was 13, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she died when I was 16, and she didn't really have the capacity to find me a guardian. It was really just me and her. So when she died, I was basically homeless. So just through the rest of my time at high school, I just lived with friends. I kind of bounced from home to home until I found a more permanent friends, family to stay with and to kind of become my adopted family. And I got into the University of Pennsylvania on a full scholarship, which is the advantage of being below the poverty line is you get to go to college for free. And I had a fantastic education. I majored in English. And then when I got out, I got into advertising. So I lived in New York and I did the advertising thing for a minute. And then I decided that I wanted to move out to LA and try to get into writing. So I worked in advertising for several years after that. And then I started writing animation kind of on the side, like nights and weekends. And I was writing with a partner at the time, and he had been a writer's assistant, and he had a friend through one of his old jobs that was running the Mary Kate and Ashley animated show. So we ended up doing a couple episodes on that. And then from there, we wrote a couple more shows. And then I went off on my own to still do the overlap of writing and advertising. And then at some point, when I felt like I had enough of a career to quit my day job, I ended up focusing more on my writing.
You know, it's unusual because, you know, coming from that advertising world where you're sometimes telling a story in a very snippet amount of time, you know, you're marketing in a short amount of time. How did that influence you, or maybe not influence you, in your animation, into your choice of animation, or where did animation grab you?
What's great about advertising is it's a very collaborative field that you work in teams. I was a copywriter and I was always teamed up with an art director. So you really, through that, learn to think very visually. And in a way, animation as well as comics, it's a very visual medium. So a lot of times you're getting ideas from artists and working in conjunction with artists to think visually. So it was really, really fantastic training. And also in terms of making deadlines, which is so important in writing when you're writing professionally.
I think a lot of people that are listening in, the young writers, they don't have an understanding that, you know, when you are writing for television specifically, those deadlines are hard deadlines. You know, for a feature, you've got more, I guess, leeway, right? Breathing room. But when you're writing for television, you know, you've got to deliver. The animation bit you. How and why did animation, you know, secure your heart?
Well, I grew up watching cartoons. I was definitely, you know, with a single mom, being like placed in front of the TV for hours and hours as my babysitter. And I just watched just, you know, cartoon after cartoon. And that was what I loved. I had no idea that someone could make a living actually doing that, or that they had writers. And I think even now, a lot of the general public thinks that animation is written by animators, which in some cases it is, but they don't realize that there are scripts, and it's the same as live action in terms of writing the script and the amount of work involved.
Well, you jumped into animation when there weren't a lot of women jumping into animation. How has that journey been for you? You know, in the beginning to now, where we're having a change of climate, embracing more diversity.
Yeah, I felt that it was a little difficult, especially since I was doing a lot of boys' action, where I feel like women in animation were always kind of pushed towards preschool and sort of like the softer shows. And that's not really my sensibility. I write comedy, I write action, I write kind of edgier stuff. So I never really had an interest in doing, you know, like the younger, you know, the sweet shows about sharing and caring. That's not me. So I think it was harder to convince people that I could write for male audiences and write for that boys 6 to 11 demo.
But you found a passion in it and you do it so well. I mean, you have a legacy of films that you've written for, you know, in a what has been, I guess, a male dominated genre, which is amazing, to be able to bring that, I guess, sensitivity from that female point of view into those male characters and utilizing that. How do you go about when you're creating a, let's say, an animated show? Where do you get your inspiration from? How are you navigating through that story concept? What's your process?
When I'm doing my own ideas, I think about what I would like to see that maybe isn't out there, something that I think would be kind of like a fun, cool idea for kids, something that would have captured me when I was in that demographic. Yeah, it's interesting. I know there's also a big toy component too when you're creating a show in animation. So I like to think, like, what would be a fun thing that I would like to play with.
Does the toy merchandising component influence you in the conceptual process of the show, or do you really just focus on, you know, this is a great idea, this is a great character, and then figure out that merchandising element?
It depends on who I'm creating it for. if it's like a network or a studio that isn't related to a toy, I kind of think of what would be a cool story and like interesting characters and what has a lot of storytelling potential and maybe in an environment that I haven't seen before. But if I'm going to a toy company that's asking for ideas, clearly they want to know that it could be turned into, plushies or cool vehicles or something that they're specializing in.
When now segueing into, you don't just create and write animation. You also have an entire life of writing live action, wonderful rom-coms, Christmas rom-coms. How did you, segue into that? Did you always know that was also a passion of yours? Or did the opportunity come and you were like, yeah, let's do a rom-com?
I do love rom-coms. I love, happy endings and romance. In addition to my geeky side. Yeah, I got the opportunity through my manager. He had some connections with some studios who were looking for some new writers. And I had, a sample, the spec feature sample. And one of the execs really liked it, so she let me pitch some ideas. And there's one idea that they really liked that we developed, which actually still hasn't been made. But for all the reasons, things don't get made. But they really liked that script, so I ended up getting a lot of rewrite work from the studio, and to the point where they would just give me a title. So it wasn't really a rewrite. There was one film, Diagnosis Delicious, where they had purchased a script throughout the entire script. They said, "Hey, what does this title make you think of?" I was like, "Well, a doctor and a chef." And we developed the story of the doctor who falls in love with a chef, the celebrity chef. And the TV movie world moves a lot quicker than the theatrical side. So, within a year, it was a film on the air.
But then you've also continued that. So has the rest of that work been more where they're giving you that title and then you're creating that story, or did you then initiate more original rom-coms to them? Because I know that you have one that's airing in 2022, which is Christmas, has to do with Christmas.
Yeah, that came to me. That was an original idea with Paris Wine and Romance. That was an idea that came from Hallmark. They had bought the pitch from a producer, and they needed a writer. And I'd met with the exec, so she paired me with the producer. So we developed that film together.
How was that experience? Because a lot of writers, youthful writers, don't have that understanding of working with somebody that's paired with that you may not have previously worked with that's assigned by the studio. How does that process work for you and with that executive?
You just get used to doing notes, and I think that's something that you learn just through years of being in the business, like how to take notes, how to implement notes. Hallmark has a lot of notes, and as most studios and networks do. I don't think I've ever worked on any project where I turned in something and they're like, "Yeah, tweak one or two things and it's fine. Let's go. Let's shoot it." So it's definitely a collaborative process, which I like, because sometimes you get stuck on something and someone will have a great solution for it, or you don't, quite know. There was a lot of, because I was a first-time writer for Hallmark, just learning their brand and, what they look for in their films and their characters, because working for the other production company, I knew, what they wanted very well, but what networks look for will change depending on who the buyer is and in some cases who the your executive is.
Right. Well, let's dig a little deeper on those notes that are coming from, the brand, from the studio. What kind of notes do they give writers? Have they given you that maybe you go, how do I facilitate this? Or sure, absolutely, I can facilitate this. Do you have conflicts sometimes with the notes, and how do you deal with that?
I think one of the notes that I find most amusing is I, especially with rom-coms, I put myself into the lead character, and I'll write her as a certain aspect of my personality or my character's traits. And the note that I'll usually get back is, "We find the lead character snarky
Why?
I guess that's how I'm coming across.
Gosh, that's funny. Because you don't come across snarky or, but that's so funny. So how do you deal?
I think that's how I'm writing my female
Sure, sure,
characters
sure, sure,
sometimes.
sure. So how do you so then how do you deal with that how do you make it less snarky? How do you approach that crazy note?
I do a dialogue pass, like in a film that I recently wrote. We had a table read, and what I thought were perfectly innocuous lines were coming across. The actress was reading them just like really snarky, and I was like, "Oh man, she is just across as a bitch here." So I did a dialogue pass, and I softened some of the dialogue, and I made her less fewer snippy comebacks. And I was just like, "Well, I can't write her the way I would talk to somebody, because it's really coming across as like I would not want to date this
Oh
woman."
my gosh, that's so funny. That's so funny. So even she had interpreted that with a little bit of an edge that you're like, oh my God. Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, and the character has a lot of dry
Right.
wit, and ultimately after I did that pass, it's like, "Oh, well, now it's fun banter instead of
Dry wit, right. Oh my God.
Which there are films for that, and I do write my snarky, snippy characters, but a G-rated rom-com is not the place for it.
Right. When you're constructing a rom-com, how do you go about that? Do you outline? Are you an outliner? Do you brainstorm on, a notepad? Each writer has their own methodology and traction.
I have, I think, a very strange process. I an obsessive outliner. I like to just really get, and I think that's something I learned from animation too, because you do an outline first and then that gets approved before you go to script. And in a lot of cases you're doing, a longer outline, so that there are no surprises when you hand it into your story editor. So I was kind of trained to do that. So I do that on the film side, that I'll write a pretty long and detailed outline. So then if I need to go to, if I have like a short time to go to script, I can just pretty much do a brain dump and then go on from there. But I write on a legal pad. That's where I break the story, because I write by hand. I find typing straight into my laptop is constricting, because I'm looking at page length. I'm like, is this scene too, like the scene's been going on for 6 pages, I have to cut it. So my mind is occupied with format instead of just raw ideas. So, and I'm also like, I don't know if I could call it diagramming. Like when I write, it's very visual. Like I'll cross things out and I'll put arrows and I'll move things. I'll do an asterisk, like move this scene to that, to page 4, and I switch things around, and I need to look at it So I think that's just the way my brain works. And then once it's, I call it the vomit draft, because it just really literally, like anything, like stream of consciousness that I'm thinking just goes into the legal pad. And then I have a dictation program and I read it in, and that way I can hear how the dialogue is sounding to me. I like to write really concisely, and I think I learned that as a copywriter. So if I'm saying, if I'm reciting the dialogue, I'll think, that's kind of a verbose way of saying it, and I'll just go back in. And then, like once it's on the computer, it's in final draft, and I fuss with it in final draft. But just to break the story, I have to do it on a big old legal pad.
On a legal pad. That's your visual. Yeah, that's your visual.
Yeah, because I can't, if I write on my screen, I'll get in trouble.
Once you get into, okay, so you've done the dictation, you've read it out loud, you go, okay, is this, am I hearing this right? And you've now got this into final draft. How many more passes are you doing? Distinct passes, like one pass for dialogue, one pass for, main character. What's your process once it lands, and how many times do you rewrite before you feel comfortable, ready to go, bam?
Probably like two or three times. I definitely do like a logic pass to make sure that all my narrative through lines are coming through. And if a scene isn't working, like I'll cut scenes, and that's also where I do like, because I never know how long it's gonna be. Once I type it in, I'm like, wow, this is 130 pages. Clearly there was too much being dumped out of my brain. So there's a lot of like cutting, like the cut and punch, like cut it, punch up the lines, cut the lines, maybe a character's not working, pull the character out. So I'll go through that, and then I do a final dialogue pass.
Gotcha. That's your final pass, is sweeping through the dialogue just to make sure. Are you also additionally then reading that out loud so you can hear it, or by that time you've already got it into your brain, so you're just kind of cleaning and tweaking as you go?
It's more cleaning and tweaking. As sometimes I'll just look at something, I'll just be like, oh, this looks clunky, or this is, this big long speech that's just gonna bore the crap out of people. So, slice, slice, slice.
That's a very fascinating process that you have. I know that some writers like to write it, write it down. They get more out of their head that way. So it's interesting to hear that that's what you do, and then you take it into a dictation and then transfer that into final draft. That's a really interesting process.
Yeah, and another thing I do is the brain dump happens very quickly, so I don't get hung up on like researching things. Especially like the Christmas movie I wrote had a lot to do with scotch, and there was like a lot of research, like what, how do you make scotch? What goes into it? What is the jargon around it? So I would just leave like question marks or little like blank spaces, like look this up, or I have like a little notation like blah 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 about scotch, so I can just keep on going with the story. And I'll do that with jokes too. I'll be like set up, and I'll try like one or two kind of like, oh yeah, this isn't working, and I'll just like star it to like come back, put a joke here. Because I don't want to be slowed down.
Right. And then you go back afterwards and implement those jokes. That's interesting. That's interesting. It truly is just getting that first concept out and then filling in and tweaking those final elements, the research elements, the comedy elements when needed. That's interesting.
Like I'll have a research day
Oh, okay.
where I'll just go and like with Paris Wine and Romance, I had to learn about, wines from Oregon and, this type of wine and Pinot Noir. And I just left just huge swaths of blank spaces in my script, like research that. And I had a day where, I called people and interviewed people and found like filled in all that
Missing
missing
info. Right.
stuff.
Cool. Now, people assume that when you are super successful, working professional as you have been, that you can write a spec script and you can get that spec script made like not a problem. It's very easy. That's their assumption, right?
If
But I know, right? If it only worked that way, right? If we could do the magic pixie dust. But I know that you had a wonderful, wonderful script that you were soliciting a few years back, many years back, in the festival circuit. You had won a lot of awards off of it. Like a brilliant, brilliant script. And it's taken a while for that to get to the point where you're now being able to get that done. Can you tell us a little bit about that story, how you came up with that story, and then, the process of where it is now?
Has been a long, arduous journey, I will say.
But on a really good script, on a really good script. One that should have not had such an arduous journey.
Well, here's the thing. I think it was a little bit before its time, and that was the problem. I feel like the market has caught up to the script now. So when I wrote it, it was the first script I ever wrote, the first screenplay I ever wrote. I did not go to film school. So just using just screenwriting books and advice from friends who were successful screenwriters, I put this together and rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it. And it's a difficult script to write because it's semi-autobiographical. It's about my life when I was 16 years old, when my mother died. And just that kind of, it takes place during a week, the week where like the rug was just pulled out from under me. Where I found like, oh, I'm 16 years old and no one knows what to do with me because I have no family. I had, nobody in place who would take me. And, what do you do in that situation? So I came up with kind of, it's partly some true events and partly like a kind of a condensation of everything that happened like in the next few years. So it was very difficult to relive that time in my life. It was a very very traumatic time in my life.
You mean when you were writing it, reliving it while you were writing it?
Yeah, reliving, that moment in time, having, come through it and, now being, in a stable life, just having that, that day to day, like, where am I going to be tomorrow? And like not knowing and not having any money, I was left with no, no inheritance, no life insurance policy, and all of my mother's doctors were suing me. So I was basically a 16-year-old, $40,000 in medical debt. So I was very fortunate that I had friends who stepped up and took care of me and kept me out of the foster system. But I had always wanted to write about it, but I was always kind of afraid to write about it because I spent so many years in therapy getting over it. I was like, do I really want to just rip the band-aid off of this again and go back to, being poor and being penniless and being homeless like that? But I feel like when you connect with your trauma, that's where the best work comes out. And it was just so like out of everything I've written, just so uniquely my voice. And it did get a lot of attention. It got me a lot of meetings. And I was a semi-finalist in the Disney program off of it. And the problem was, I would go on these meetings, and the execs just love, they're like, what a unique story. The writing is so sharp. But we can never make this. No one will ever go see it. A 16-year-old girl in an R-rated dark comedy about death.
Right. Amazing. But this is one of the, but you have to understand, you have to understand. I read so many scripts on a given year. This script has always been in my head. It's an amazing script. The journey is amazing. The way the character handles the situation or what happens is amazing. So for an executive to say that, granted, this is there's been a chunk of time, way back when you wrote this. I shouldn't say way back, but a chunk of time in the past. You're right. I think the timing maybe has allowed the executives to catch up with the story.
Well, what was happening was, I had gotten, a lot of notice from it, and everyone said, oh, we want to see your next mainstream commercial screenplay. And I tried a couple of those, and it just, I think my heart wasn't in it. And then when I started writing, these rom-coms, I think I became just a better feature writer because I was writing so much, and I really, got that screenplay format down. So I kind of put Rules of Flushing on the back burner. I was like, well, I have this kind of growing screenwriting career, and animation is booming, and I was getting into comics and graphic novels, and I was like, well, it's still a great writing sample. It got me a lot of work. So it's been a fantastic writing sample. And I thought, well, if I have a really bulletproof writing sample, then, it was worth it. And I really didn't think about getting made. And then with the advent of all the streamers, with Netflix and Amazon, I started seeing these, R-rated teen comedies and these girl centers, because I was getting a lot of comments from execs and from management saying, well, can you put her in college? And I was like, if you're in college, you're an adult, and you're not facing having to go into a foster system. So it was, I wasn't going to change it. I was like, I'd rather not have this made because I have other things that I can sell and make. I don't need to, ruin, the story of me. My life story just to sell it. So then, all the these YA movies came out, and Booksmart was just a fantastic movie and a great example of what I wanted to do. And in the meantime, like some directors had been interested, some producers had been interested, and they're like, yeah, we really love the script, but we don't know where to put it. We don't know, no one's going to finance it, no one's going to make it, whatever. And then about a year ago, I think this like YA beacon went off, and everyone's like, wow, we want to do, some gritty, female like YA teen stories. And that was when I found a production company that we were just like on the same page about making it. And they had some great notes about updating it. And I had done a few years past, like a pretty big rewrite, because I felt like I'd changed as a writer. So I wanted to go through it and kind of take out some of the rookie mistakes that I made, and like sharpen the dialogue and deepen the and make it more diverse and sharpen the characters. So I did that. And now it's out to directors. So it's optioned. It's, so hopefully someone will fall in love with it and make it.
That's it's an amazing story, not only from the standpoint of your life, but it's an amazing story that you were able to craft. you know, utilizing this trauma. I think sometimes writers, you know, they step away and they don't utilize those traumas that make you uniquely interesting in scripts. And it's, you know, you're putting your heart out there. So it's a dangerous thing, right? Because not only are you being judged on your writer, but you're also being judged on that story, which is so who you are. So the story in itself is amazing, but the way you crafted it, even when I had read that version, was truly unique and fascinating. And fascinating that, you know, you yourself survived that and you've pulled yourself up by the bootstraps and been able to succeed in your life and in your career and in entertainment and in art. So who's the director you really want? Like, if you had anything you could choose for, who would be the one director that you would say, that's the one?
Yeah, I think I love Booksmart so much. Like, I would love to give it to Olivia Wilde. I think Emerald Fennell is doing amazing work. I don't know if this is her thing. But there are so many great, like, rising female directors out there. I know I worked with the producers and we came up with kind of a wish list, and I was like, I would love anybody on this list to do it.
What's your advice for a young woman, young writer? Doesn't have to be a woman, but, you know, a young writer coming up through the ranks, or a young filmmaker, what would you give them from your years of experience that you can share?
I would say, and I got some really good advice when I first moved out to LA, from someone who I went to college with, who had already been successful as a TV writer. And he said, writing is 5% talent, 95% sales. And I think it's so important. Like, you have to have that good script. But I know so many people with great scripts who just, they don't get it out there, and they don't get it in front of the right people, and they're not out, you know, going to networking events and going to, you know, coffee with people and reaching out. And it's such a fantastic time when you're starting out. And it's a great time to be a writer, first of all, because there's so many outlets. There's podcasting. There's, you know, you can make your own web comic. It's a fantastic time to be breaking in. And I think, like, you just need to get your work in front of people. And I've gotten so much work just from going to comics conventions and just meeting people, eventually getting on panels. I was on a panel a couple Comic-Cons ago with just a fantastic group of women writers, and I ended up, you know, working with one of them on a project just through just meeting there. And it was just, you know, one of the most wonderful experiences of my career.
That's really good advice, because a lot of people that are listening in are youthful writers and filmmakers coming up the ranks, and they don't understand how much networking plays into that faction.
I would say, especially in animation where writers hire other writers, I would say 90% of the work I get comes through friends, comes through people I know. I know I may be running a show next year. I already know who my staff is. They're people that I know who are my friends who I've worked with before. And I hate to say that, because I'm always like, yeah, everyone just hires their friends. And it's not like I wouldn't give a new writer a chance, because I definitely will. And I feel like we need to encourage new writers and people coming up and you know, diverse writers. But it is so much like, I'll run into someone at, you know, like a mixer at a bar, and they'll be like, oh, yeah, you know. I just got a show greenlit, and now that I see you, you'd be great for it.
Well, that's truly, people don't understand that it's a relationship business. And so, even putting yourself out there in that remembering factor, like, oh my God, yes, of course. Why didn't I think of you? Now that I see you, of course you'd be the right person for me. Yeah. So, what is a dirty little secret that you wish somebody had told you years ago that you've now learned through your travels?
And this is something that I don't do. Never tear down other writers. Even it's something I don't do as a rule, but I've seen other writers do that, and they'll go on Twitter or social media, just like, I really hate this show, and this is really garbage writing, and this is really trashy. Because you don't know who's going to read that, and you never know who's going to hire you. And you never want that out there. So if I don't like something, I just try to keep it to myself. Because it's also, you don't know what the writer went through before that final product airs. Because you don't know like what their draft looked like. So there's a lot of like, oh, this movie came out, what a crappy writer. It's like, no, they're probably a good writer, and then 30 execs got involved and watered it down. It's not their fault. So tearing down another writer for something that is mostly because to get produced, like unless someone's doing you a favor or there's nepotism involved, you're going to be a good writer. This is hard. It's hard to get anything made. So I feel like tearing down other people's work is just unfair. And it's just kind of bad form. So I would say, you get together with your friends, you see a movie, you hate it. So, oh, I would never have done that. Or, they must have been stoned when they wrote it, Fine, but you don't want to do this whole screed that people are going to see because you don't know you're going to be in a room with that writer and they could have the decision to hire you and just go, oh, you wrote that really shitty thing about me that went around on Twitter. So you never want to be that person.
That's true. That's a brilliant piece of advice and truly a dirty little secret that you never want to air that dirty laundry out in public because it will circle back somehow, somewhere, and you don't want to be that person.
Well,
So.
not everything I write is gold. And for whatever reason, sometimes it's notes I've had to do. Sometimes it's just a bad fit for me. So I don't like to think someone is saying like, wow. And I just read a review of my graphic novel. I don't know who wrote it, and they just like tore me a new one. And I was just like, you can take reviews with a grain of salt, and it wasn't, a professional. I don't know if this was, some kid sitting around or like another frustrated writer. But I was just like, yeah, you just don't want to just put something brutal out there. I don't want to be that person.
Words to live by. Life words to live by. Joe L. Selner, thank you so much for coming on Best in Fest. Your story is amazing. I know you're going to find the right director to take that story to screen. It's just around the corner for you. So thank you for being on Best in Fest. For all those that want to see the video component, it will be on the LaFemme YouTube channel. And for those that are listening in on the podcast, don't forget to like us and rate us. Thank you so much. We are out. Best in Fest.